Prego.
Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. It's Monday. It's March 2nd. We have two bills today. We're going to take them in reverse order because we're also keeping an eye out for Senator Dembrough on House Bill 2611. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3063. Victoria?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3063 appropriates monies to the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to be expended for grant program that distributes monies to community colleges to increase the number of underserved, low-income, and first-generation college-bound students who enroll in community college and make progress towards a degree or a certificate, declares an emergency, is effective July 1, 2015, and has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Colleagues, remember this is the bill that we weren't able to hear at the same time that our friends from PCC were here last week. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you. It's amazing how intimidating you guys are out here. Good morning, Chair Reed, Vice Chair Wisnett, colleagues on the committee, Joe Gallegos, House District 30 representative. And you heard about this last Wednesday. This is the Aspirations to College bill. It continues the strategic investment in higher education, workforce development, aspirations to college program, 2015 to 2017 biennium. These funds will be allocated through $3 million dollars to the community college workforce development for the next biennium to fund a competitive grant program available to community colleges throughout the state. These grant dollars are targeted for programs providing access to and support to students from low-income backgrounds or who are first in their families to go to college. The goal is to leverage our state investment by partnering with local business communities, philanthropic community, and local governments to provide these students a chance to not only go to college but be supported through the first two years of community college. PCC's Future Connect is a great example of how this work is done right through the partnership with cities of Beaverton and Hillsboro. PCC supports cohorts of students through their first 2 years of college and helps them plan for the years ahead. Students are guided through the FAFSA process, which you know that's half of getting through to college. They're required to take a college success course where credit costs are covered through the scholarship and work one-on-one with a college success coach. After the first year, Hillsboro's program was like 83% retention rate. Beaverton was at 96%. So these are remarkable kinds of success rates. As much as I love to see this success in my district, the goal of the bill is to extend these opportunities throughout the state so that students across the state can work for the tools to succeed, help us reach that elusive 40-40-20 that we're all working toward. I have to say that you know, when we've incorporated innovations into this committee, and I think this is such a great example of how we sort of set the foundation for that process. I think that the Future Connect and the way that we're talking about partnerships with this program are just, to me, the ideal model. I just don't believe it should be the state that carries the full burden, but that we should really look for partnerships with the private sector, with philanthropic organizations, and even in this case, municipalities that have kicked in. I believe it was in the last session, Portland, the city of Portland kicked in 100,000, Beaverton and Hillsborough also gave up that much money as well. And so it's those partnerships, I think, that are really significant in this particular program. Answer any questions you might have?
Thank you, Representative. For the questions? Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Chair Reed. Just a couple of definition questions, actually, and I'll just list them. You can respond as you want. How would the distribution of funds with the counties participating that you've mentioned, obviously they have maybe a leg up on the program, how would the distribution of funds go to all the community? Is there a formula with that? And what is the definition of college bound?
A couple of things. One, the distribution formula, I'm not really clear on specifically, but I do know that it's a need-based allocation per student, and it's run through the workforce office. And so, like I said, I don't know exactly the details in terms of how it's distributed. In terms of college bound, these students are identified in high school, so seniors in high school or juniors, whatever. But again, the criteria being first generation, low income, and from there, they're then encouraged to apply for these particular scholarships.
And Representative Hayden, we have two people coming up after from PCC and the Community College Association that might have answers to those questions as well. Yeah. Representative McEwen?
Oh, Chair Reed, this is just a technical question. On page 2, line 3, it refers to the Office of the Chancellor of the Oregon University System shall coordinate services. Is that...
Again, you know, the actual, administration is something perhaps the other testifiers could answer.
Okay.
Victoria, you had a comment on that?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative, I was just going to say there are many, we will come across many references still in the statutes, and those will all be taken care of with conflict amendments toward the end of the session.
Great. Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, I appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much, Representative Gagos. Megan Moyer and John Wyckoff, please.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm the Director of Government Relations for Portland Community College. And I wanted to thank Representative Gallegos and Reed and everyone else who has sponsored this legislation. This is a continuation and an ask for an expansion from last year's 4116, which appropriated $750,000 to Aspiration to College programs through the Community College and Workforce Development Department. And PCC was lucky enough to be one of the grant recipients through our Future Connect program. We received $225,000 in grant money, which allowed us to expand access to the Future Connect program outside of just the three cities in which we formally partner. So we were able to offer scholarship and support to students out in St. Helens and other places in Columbia County, as well as some students in Yamhill County. We are so supportive of our relationship with the state because it is allowing us to leverage private philanthropic dollars, which I think is for us our model for supporting Future Connect is right now we're at a three-way pie. The state coming in creates a four-way pie, which is for us more sustainable, where we work with local governments who contribute. The city of Portland actually contributes $380,000 a year to Future Connect. City of Beaverton is $100,000. City of Hillsborough is also $100,000. And what we're able to leverage with that money is our private philanthropic. So our foundation side goes out and raises from organizations like the Reeser Family Foundation, Powell's have contributed, and we bring in the other half of that. And we're so proud of what Future Connect has been able to accomplish for low-income first-generation students. But we are needing help in order to expand to areas where the municipalities are not able to participate at the level that some of the larger cities are. We are needing help balancing out what the institution itself is able to contribute. And with results that we're seeing with Future Connect, it's not so much the scholarship, although I think that really does bring people in the door and make them think about college when they weren't before, but it is the intensive level of support that they receive. And those aren't tuition dollars, and you don't see that in, you know, amount of contribution in, by FTE. These are not things that are part of the formulas we think about when we fund community college. But for students who do not come from backgrounds where family is knowledgeable about higher education, these type of supports really make a huge difference. And we're really able to show that. It's one of those programs that you just, you can't look at the numbers and say this isn't worth it. We are seeing over 50% improvement, actually 100% improvement in retention with these students. We are seeing people inspire their siblings, their cousins, their networks back home to consider higher education when they never considered it. And so we thank you so much for your commitment to Aspiration to College programs, particularly Future Connect for PCC. And we are asking you to consider increasing that contribution so that we can serve more students. We are only touching the tip of the iceberg of students who would benefit from this level of student support, which is really hard every year to have to make decisions and turn students away who this really could be a difference maker in their lives. And we do believe that the state becoming a larger participant with us can help us leverage those private dollars to make it available to more students. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Mr. Wyckoff.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff from the Oregon Community College Association. And I'd just like to start by thanking Representative Gallegos for his tenacious support of funding for this program. It's not a lot of money. I mean, if you look at the scope of the whole state budget, but it is there are dollars that go very, very far in the lives of the students and their families that these dollars are directed to. What we know, you know, from national data is that low-income students whose parents didn't attend college have a fairly low likelihood of attending college. And programs like this really make a difference at getting them to be college bound and getting the kind of careers that can support a family and sustain a family. We have about 14 colleges that are currently accessing the funds in this program, so it definitely has statewide reach, and so it gets to sort of all corners of Oregon. It is the money was awarded through a competitive grant process at the Community Colleges and Workforce Development Department. Beyond that, to get to Representative Hayden's question, I don't have a lot of detail about the process. We'd be happy to get back to you with how that process was conducted. But beyond it being a competitive grant process, I don't have a whole lot of detail on it. But again, how I can get you more detail about how that process was carried out. So I think I can just sum up by saying we're very supportive of this program. We appreciate the past support of the legislative body and hope you will continue to support students who are trying to, or who are in many cases kind of breaking a cycle of poverty and getting a post-secondary education that will help them support a family.
Thank you. You mentioned one thing that struck me. You mentioned 14 institutions that are using it. That would suggest there are three who are not. Do you know why they are not?
Chair Reed, I was sort of hoping I wouldn't get asked that question. And then, no,
bring out 14.
But I'd be happy to get back to you with that as well.
I'd be interested in that, too. Thanks. Other questions for this panel? Representative Nierman. You have something to add?
Yeah. Please. And if I may, it may be that they applied and were not awarded a grant. So all 17 may have, in fact, applied, but I'd be happy to get back to you with that.
Yes, please. Representative Nierman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So either Mr. Wyckoff or Ms. Moyer, the definitions in here, I'm looking back at the law that it refers to. It says to increase the number of underserved, low-income, and first-generation college-bound students. Are there any definitions of those? Does that come from the FAFSA? Or how do you, like, for instance, how do you know if I'm a first-generation student? Did I put that on a form somewhere, or do you take my word for it? Or?
I know how we do it. Chair Reed, Representative Nierman, I can't speak to CCWD because I'm not 100% sure. I do know how PCC defines that, and we do verify that. That means that for first generation is defined as that neither parent graduated with a bachelor's degree. And low income, we use Pell eligibility as a threshold, and underrepresented, although that is not a criteria in Future Connect, is typically identification in a historically underrepresented minority community.
And Representative McEwen, you had a comment on that question,
too. Chair Reed, a lot of that determination comes from the filing of your free application for federal and student aid. So that information is in your FAFSA.
Okay.
Other questions? Representative Gallegos.
I just want to make one final comment. In that recognizing that this is a demographic that we're really struggling to get and reach in terms of the 40-40-20. So this is actually a very strategic effort to really address that population. Thank you.
Thanks. Comments? Okay. Thank you both very much. That completes the list of people who signed up to testify on House Bill 3063. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on 3063? I don't see any. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3063 and open our public hearing on House Bill 2611. Victoria. While she's getting us started, Representative Gagos is making his way over. Senator Denbrough getting settled.
Perfect.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2611 extends by 6 years the period during which universities with institutional governing boards must participate in mandated shared services under the same terms, conditions, funding model, and policy frameworks as existed in 2013. Declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you very much. Who'd like to go first? Senator, Representative?
I'll start off, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Chair Reed, members of the committee, I'm Michael Denbrough. I'm the state senator for District 23. That's Northeast and Southeast Portland. And it's great to be before the House Higher Ed Committee. Although I have to say, being here and this issue provoked a lot of memories surfacing that I had preferred not to ever look at anymore. Some of you were spared the ordeals of what we've been going through with higher ed over the last 6 years, but not all of you have. And so some of you will go down this road with me in pain together. You know, just to turn the clock back on this issue, and this, by the way, the bill has to do with the problem of what happens to shared administrative services when you have a system that was a single system becoming split up into a number of universities governed by their own boards. And if you turn the clock back to 2009, which was my first encounter with this this issue, it was my first session here. Back then, the university system was actually considered a government agency, sort of similar to DMV. That was the analogy that was used. And there was a desire back then by the university system, by OUS, to move away from agency status and become a public university system that would have a certain amount of autonomy from all the nuts and bolts of the administrative rules and the DAS imposed processes that other agencies deal with. My first session, I had to work on giving the system the ability to form subcommittees of the State Board of Higher Education. They actually didn't have that authority back then, and that was our big legislative accomplishment in 2009, was to allow them to do some of their work in subcommittees. Anyway, it became clear that there were really good reasons for OUS to move away from that kind of status. And so the Speaker and the President created a work group or a task force that Rep. Reed at that time was the co-chair of, and we examined this issue through the summer of, I think it was 2010. And then, did a lot of work that ultimately led to what became Senate Bill 242 in 2011, which did move the Oregon University system away from being a state agency to being a public university system. And incidentally, that legislation also created what would become the HEC, the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. One of the issues that I remember being wrestled with back then is what happens to university employees being part of PEB and PERS back then, if the universities were no longer to be, if OUS was no longer to be a university system, should its employees be part of PERS and PEB? And we had a bunch of discussions about that. Ultimately, the decision was made to leave that up to a labor management committee that would be created, and which ultimately by 2012 decided it made sense for the university employees to remain in PEB for a variety of reasons that I could go into, but that the university faculty already had an optional retirement system they could be part of, and some improvements were made to that back then. I think that the OUS, in seeking public university status, was hoping to forestall some pressure for the University of Oregon to form its own board, and then subsequently Portland State as well. But that turned out to be a train that was not going to stop. And so we did create another work group in 2012, which was called the Task Force on Higher Education and Governance, House Bill 4061, that Committee Administrator Cox knew very well. She called it the JUG, the Joint University Governance Task Force. Rep. Johnson was one of the co-chairs on that with me and Senator Haas. One of the things that we spent a lot of time on back then, and it was actually charged specifically in the legislation authorizing that task force, was how do you make sure if, you know, one or more universities leave the system, that that doesn't create a negative effect on those that remain in the system, or just simply on other universities. And the issue there was not really so much academic services, because we had the heck to deal with that, but those administrative services, you know, like payroll, like the central bank, you know, that the different universities could draw on, most notably risk management. That was a real issue. We spent hours and hours on that issue, and ultimately, in Senate Bill 242, which was passed in 2013, and that dealt with the that created the boards or the possibility for boards, and it dealt with administrative services, whereas House Bill 3120 dealt with the HEC and academic services. See, I'm bringing all these nightmares, these memories back, right, Rep. Johnson? Yeah. What we decided to do in Senate Bill 270 was to create a work group of university presidents to deal with some of the shared services, those shared academic services, and then a few others we reserved and said, you know, those are going to remain sort of to the side, and nothing will happen with them until 2015, when the legislature will be able to sort of revisit this and see where are we at this point. Remember, in 2013, we had a pretty good sense that the University of Oregon was going to form its own board. We had a sense that Portland State probably would. We didn't know about any of the others. And in fact, as many of you will remember, last year in 2014, we did pass legislation that would allow the regional universities a path to form their own boards. I'm sorry, the technical and regional universities, the TRUs, to form their own boards. However, giving the State Board of Higher Education the ability to put requirements on them, and those requirements could lead to those boards going away in 2018 after final review in 2017. So these issues, we're still, I think, very much in flux in terms of what's happening with these boards, what's happening certainly with the technical and regional universities. And so I think that's really what has generated this legislation, the idea that we're not yet at a point where we know where we're going to land as far as university governance. And so it makes sense for us on those issues that you know, related to PEB and PERS and collective bargaining and risk management, that we sort of extend the sunset, as it were, and have them remain as they are to provide a sense of certainty and stability with them for the next few years. So that's what this legislation is all about. And after Representative Gallego speaks, I'd be happy to answer any questions as long as they don't generate too painful a set of memories. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. First of all, I just want to thank Representative Johnson and the senator for the tremendous work they've done and over these years to bring this reorganization of our institutions together. I can't imagine the real challenge of, I mean, you'll hear me speak up there to a number of the presenters who talk about changes in higher education in our state, and how I just marvel at the challenge of the cultural changes that are being developed, and to think about then these institutions and actually taking these systems, separate institutions, and bringing them together and sort of streamlining so that we save money and also have better results with our higher education. I mean, this, like I said, I can't imagine the challenge that would present. And here we're talking this morning about, I'm going to address three specific pieces of the legislation that we're presenting to you. And I'm going to read, because my staff did the work putting these talking points together, I need to make sure that I stay true to their efforts, their work. So good morning again. This is Joe Gallegos, House District 30, presenting on House Bill 2611. With our new higher ed governing structure, faculty and classified staff believe that shared services as they were established in 2013 should continue. In an effort to respond to the needs of our students and educators and our taxpayers. First of all, so we've got three points that we're going to address in this bill. First of all, pooling resources saves money throughout the system. While one big campus may be able to get a better deal in terms of risk management costs, by leaving the pool, the shared services costs would dramatically increase for some of the smaller schools and programs. The resources, including general fund and tuition, should be used to maximize the use of money statewide, not just for one campus. The second point addressed in the bill is that it wouldn't be possible to find the same level of benefit offered through PEB and PERS for a lower cost for employees. If campuses were to leave PERS and PEB, they would find cost savings by cutting back on benefits packages to employees. Also, opting out of PEB and PERS puts increased pressure on and costs on the participants that are left behind, and our shared goal of controlling health care costs while maintaining quality of care are put at risk through the fragmentation of purchasing power. And then finally, the third point being that the potential damage to our regional universities. The TRUs play an integral part in our state, both in educating Oregonians in rural areas and giving people affordable options for higher education, especially for folks who are first in their families to attend schools. Going it alone is not the best option for their sustainability or for the valuable tuition and state support dollars. So with House Bill 2611, we address these concerns by extending the continuation of shared services for risk management, collective bargaining, and benefits through PERS and PEVs for the next 6 years. Students, faculty, and staff know that there are a lot of changes underway in our university system, with seven new independent boards in place beginning this this year. The continuance of shared services is necessary to control costs for students, taxpayers, and to preserve the value of our institutions of higher learning. So those are the points that are covered in the legislation, and we'll be happy to take questions. Then, and we'll also be followed by others who can answer more specific questions if we can't. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for either of these legislators? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that recitation. I've got to pronounce you the chamber historian. but Senator, there was a lot of angst and some unknowns, obviously, when we made the transition through Senate Bill 270 and subsequent to that, and then obviously leading into the end of the creation of the governing boards. First, it was 1, 2, 3, and then, you know, 7, and so forth. And the shared services obviously was an unknown. What I think I've been most pleased by or surprised by and gratified by has been the way that the universities, particularly the 7 presidents, have banded together, you know, signed off on with joint letters of support and so forth. And just the very collegial, I think, response that they've had to the area of shared services, because I think it's exceeded, I think, most of our expectations for how it would go. But again, I guess I'm not hearing of tremendous angst about the status quo. Specifically regarding the need for extending a sunset or adding to the requirement or the statutorial requirement that they continue to collaborate. I think it's happening. Would you like to comment on that regarding what you've seen and heard and any angst that you might be sensing from the universities?
You know, thanks, Chair Reed and Rep. Johnson. So I think there's a difference between what I've been hearing publicly and privately, to be honest. And I think there remains a lot of angst in private, particularly among people at the TRUs. And, you know, it's not surprising because, you know, we are in a state of transition, mm-hmm. and they are really concerned about their allocation. I mean, the universities are concerned about their allocation in general, of course, and the impact of different allocation levels. What will that have on their ability to? I mean, if we're awash in money, then shared services becomes less of a problem. But if you know, if the budget doesn't come in at the level of their goals, then there are going to be problems that flow from that. And so, you know, privately, I would say that there are a lot of concerns, and there is a desire to, again, let's keep things as they are for a few years and give us a few years of stability, and then we'll, you know, see where we are and be able to proceed from there.
I hear what you're saying. I think one of the items has been that I've heard referred to has been the redeployment of the OUS budget. How can that be distributed equitably? And maybe that could, in and of itself, might be enough to dispel some of the financial fears and so forth out there. But I guess the other thing I would say about mandating them making them have to stay in this relationship is I do think it could perhaps stifle some creativity and some cost-saving measures that perhaps individually that some of them may take on. For instance, I've heard from some directly that opting out of PEB or having some flexibility there could be a cost-saving measure for the university. So mandating that they stay in these relationships may not necessarily be in students' best interest as we think, you know, about the whole system. Because I think, we've got seven universities. They're all in a different place, and some of them are going to be a little more aggressive and creative, I think, in how they manage their resources and try to allow themselves to operate as efficiently as possible in the interest of their students. So I can certainly see pros and cons of your proposal.
Yeah, if I can respond to that. Yeah, I mean, that's something that's been looked at over the years. And I think that, you know, if you look at it in terms of the big picture, yes, it's possible that an individual university could do better on its own in the short term. The question is that sustainable? You know, will those savings sustain over the long term? But also, what is the effect of their pulling out of the system? What does that have on the PEB system in general? Is that then going to lead to an increase in PEB costs for, you know, for PEB as a whole, which means that the state has less money to give to the universities because they have to put more money into PEB? So, you know, it kind of, it's not clear, even though it may meet the short-term interests of an individual university. If you look at it comprehensively and over the long term, it could actually be harmful.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisden. Representative Gagas, did you have a comment?
I just want to make a follow-up comment. I think one needs to appreciate, I've spent 40 years in higher education as a faculty member, as an administrator, even as a student, for that matter. And I think that what one needs to appreciate, again, is we're talking about systems change that is pretty radical. And to what we're asking with this bill is really an extension that would allow for some more time for socialization into a new system of operating. And I think that all of us can understand that change is always difficult and that we need some time. This bill is asking for more time to adjust to that change, to accommodate that change.
Thank you. Representative Wisden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for all your work on this, Senator and Representative Johnson. I've been on the fringes of it for a couple of sessions. Senator, you mentioned in your testimony something to the effect a school could opt out or get out. What statute allows that? And does this bill affect their ability to still get out of what we've created?
Thanks. Rep. Wisden, so Senate Bill 270 looked at, you know, all of the shared services that, you know, were part of the Oregon University system, and it the majority of them, the great majority of them, decided that universities could, you know, through a process of the university presidents working together on, you know, what they call the shared services enterprise, decide which of them they would want to remain part of and which they would want to opt out of. There were three services that were that everyone had to stay in that weren't up for discussion. One was collective bargaining, and we're talking about collective bargaining for classified staff. The faculty at the different universities have individual bargaining units. The second was PEB and PERS, the benefits, and then the third was risk management. And I will say that, there was not really serious talk about individual universities coming out of the collective bargaining or really coming out of the benefits after that initial look that I mentioned. But the risk management, I think, was seen to be the trickiest of them. But it was decided, okay, we'll come back to this in 2015. They have those are not up for discussion until 2015, and that's why it's before you today.
Quick follow-up.
Yes, please.
Senator, our representative, why 6 years? Who came up with the 6 years? And Chair Reed has talked about we're going to maybe have a presentation about Southern Oregon and Eastern Oregon about their situation. So if we extend this another 6 years and someone gets in financial trouble, then they could still change as far as shared services on the retirement benefits. Could you answer those, please?
I think the 6 years, and I think the 6 years is a function of, as I mentioned, the status of the truce is still kind of provisional until the end of 2017. If there's a decision made that, independent board status for those universities you know, is not the way to go, because they haven't met the metrics that are out there, the metrics for success, there'll have to be a decision of what to do with them. And so the idea was that keeping everybody together until 2021, that gives a lot of that gives ample time for whatever emerges potentially from that to prove itself, and you know, we'll know where we're going, So, just to give a sort of comfortable window.
Thank you, sir.
Yep. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Reardon?
Could you, Senator, could you remind me, how long have these boards actually been working together, the new ones?
Well, I think it's actually just the big universities, the research universities, their boards have been in effect for a year and a half now. And the technical and regionals, they're in their first year.
It seemed like very little time for a board to even get to know each other and learn how to function together. And for that reason, I would think this bill makes a lot of sense just for stability.
Thank you. Other questions?
Let's see. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
Next up is Rob Fulmer.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Rob Fulmer, and I am testifying in favor of continuing university shared services via HB 2611. I've worked at Portland State University for the past decade, providing IT planning and support to students and faculty. I currently serve on the Strategic Planning Committee for PSU, am a member of SEIU 503, help form and lead our campus's student and worker coalition Together for PSU, and represent non-faculty employees of Oregon Public Community Colleges and Universities as a commissioner on the HEC. In 2011 and 12, I served on the SB 242 Health and Welfare Plan Option Review Committee, which is the labor management committee that Senator Denbrough referenced, that looked at pulling OUS institutions out of PEB as one possible health insurance option. While OUS as a whole may have had a large enough covered membership to mitigate against the reduction in overall pool size that separate coverage would require, individually, the universities do not, and the costs, if one or more institutions withdrew, would necessarily go up. In 2012, the review committee concluded that OUS staying in PEB was what was best for OUS workers and for the state of Oregon. What was a bad idea then for OUS is a worse one now for individual institutions. Changing gears from benefits to collective bargaining, another critical aspect of this bill. As the PSU member of the classified worker bargaining team in the 2011 through 13 contract negotiations, I saw how challenging it was to get equal pay for equal work across the state and the pressure felt by institutions, particularly the TRUs, to balance their budget by offering represented university workers a poor contract. In the previous 2009 to 11 contract, classified workers took furloughs while other employees at most institutions did not. We have historically had a hard time getting a fair contract. The budget pressures and decline in state revenue for the universities has been particularly difficult for the TRUs, and this has meant that we have continued to feel squeezed on campus. The reality is, being an office specialist or electrician at OIT or PSU or U of O requires the same background and skill and should be paid the same. But because some campuses face different financial pressures, we have found that the budgets at the TRUs have nearly led to a strike the last two contracts. In addition to making sure that people get paid fairly across the state, breaking up the bargaining unit would be an additional cost to the universities. Over time, we will need to come up with new ways to bargain with the seven campuses, since there is no longer a system. But it doesn't make sense to have seven different bargaining tables, all at the cost to students and taxpayers. Despite many years of trying to improve wages, over a quarter of the workers SEIU represents are still food stamp eligible. Keeping our bargaining unit together at least gives us a chance to continue to try and change that and reduce inequality by negotiating a living wage contract for the lowest paid workers at Oregon's universities. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Just kind of a follow-up on the six-year since these boards have been together for 18 months.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but just the three majors.
Okay, three major ones. As you include additional institutions in this, it seems like making that four times as long without having the opportunity to look back and say, okay, is everything working here properly? To the point that they haven't had enough time to get together to organize to really get to know each other. Maybe on the other side, they haven't also had the time to get together to figure out what the barriers might be. Is there opportunity to make that time a little bit shorter and have a review on that?
I think that the six-year number was picked because it was felt that while the boards have been together for 18 months, they were only empowered in July 1st. I mean, they basically spent their first part of the time together just sort of trying to get the lay of the land. We're not just talking about new board members. We're talking about, like, whole new boards. I can say at Portland State, they're still sort of trying to figure out all of the nuances of public meetings rules. So it takes time for an institution like that to get its feet under it. And I think the feeling with the six-year date was that in that amount of time, they should be able to get a pretty clear picture of where they're going and whether or not even. So just to step back. Boards are in place, but they haven't even been thoroughly evaluated by the HEC. I mean, this is something that is the state of Oregon is going to want to do very carefully, because higher education is something that's obviously critical to the state's goals. 40-40-20 is critical, and as a member of the HEC, I can tell you that, you know, the jury's still out on boards. I mean, we haven't really seen them operating for very long. We haven't even done the first tuition review, and so I think that window was chosen because as a reflection of the fact that these are all very new and these things take time to evaluate.
Questions? I want to make sure I heard something you said correctly. You said a quarter of SEIU members are eligible.
It's actually more than a quarter. The number is 27% are food stamp eligible for a family of four. That's correct.
Is that amongst higher ed?
In higher ed.
Or all?
No, just in the higher ed bargaining unit.
Okay.
Yeah. I think people don't understand just sort of where we are in terms of our wages, and I wanted to make sure that you guys did understand that. And this is with collective bargaining with all seven universities. I mean, you need. It's critical to understand that if Eastern or Southern or other smaller bargaining units are standing alone, they're going to be under tremendous pressure from those institutions for their contract negotiations. I mean, part of the reason that we're able to get the get those workers fair settlements is because they're bargaining with U of O and PSU and U of O, which OSU, which are the by far the largest. So,
yep. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Gallegos, were you?
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just to make sure everybody knows what's coming, we have Jose Padin, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Sean Kane, Mario Parker Milligan, if you three could come forward. And then after that, we'll have Debbie Koreski and Hans Bernard. So Mario is not here, is he? I guess we'll hear from you two gentlemen. Please.
Chair Reed, members of the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development, good morning. My name is Dr. Jose Padin. I'm elected president of the Oregon Conference of the American Association of University Professors, As elected president of our Oregon AAUP, my work is volunteer service on behalf of our students, our faculty members, and our universities. I am an associate professor of sociology at Portland State University, and I've been an Oregon educator for 19 years. On behalf of the Oregon Conference of the American Association of University Professors, of our faculty collective bargaining chapters at University of Oregon and Portland State University, and also our individual members at private and public universities across Oregon, I am here to strongly support House Bill 2611. Our ability to reach 40-40-20 benchmarks means expanding access to higher education for underserved populations in Oregon. And I know that many legislators and state officials have been deeply involved in thinking about ways to serve those students and to make college affordable to them. Ending shared services, we believe, would undermine those efforts. Rural students in particular would be hard hit. Shared services are most important for some of the truths, Southern and Eastern in particular. I understand from my colleagues at Southern and Eastern that them keeping their doors open might literally depend on continuing this pooling of resources, and that concerns us. When the legislature passed SB 270, legislators saw fit to require these shared services, and this, we believe, continues to be a sensible idea. The three shared services included in this legislation are more cost-effective for Oregon taxpayers when they are pooled. Senator Dembrough already made reference to risk management, for example, being more cost-effective when spread over a larger risk pool. We are troubled by the idea that if shared services are not continued, a regional university could be put in serious jeopardy with one jury decision, and that is something to ponder. I'm struck when listening to the question about the six-year period, and I was wondering what our thoughts might be on that. And I'm thinking of how little time 6 years is in the real world in complex endeavors. Our new institutional boards are composed of folks from the community who are volunteers. They have full-time jobs. At our universities, when a new president comes on board and has a full-time staff that is paid to do nothing but run the university, 4 years in, there's still some rookie errors, and staff is finding their legs. So how about for the volunteer members trying to govern our institutions? Our universities are moving into an era of greater institutional autonomy, and what we essentially have right now is a federation of public universities, and I still feel that federation, for some purposes, will need a center with the capacity to support our autonomy. And some AUP Oregon believes that it would be best for our students, for our universities, and for our members to extend shared services for this period of 6 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Padin. Question, Representative?
Professor, you assume my question was for a shorter period, or my question was about a shorter period. I just ask, why 6 years? Why not 10 years?
Okay. I don't have an answer for that. I'm
not honest.
Dr. Kane?
Chairman Reed and committee members, my name is Sean Kane. I'm a professor of biology and neuroscience at Eastern Oregon University. I'm also the president of AFT Local 6200. And thanks for the opportunity to talk in support of this bill. I've heard lots of interesting things today. I want to give you specific examples of the challenges we face at Eastern Oregon University as a one of the truths. Talking with interim president Kenton, we've laid out what the services might cost the university. President Kenton came up with a figure of around $2 million. This $2 million represents more than 7% of our general fund. I can speak directly to what this might mean to our university, because we've just gone through restructuring where we've needed to come up with an additional $1.7 million in savings between our expenditures and our revenues. Basically, we had 131 faculty members that excludes online adjuncts. with that sustainability plan, we lost 26 of those faculty members. This resulted in the loss of over 15 concentrations, three programs. These directly affect the students from rural Oregon. In our 40-40-20 plan, one of the largest hurdles is to get rural students, underrepresented students, low-income students, and first-generation students through the university system. This change in allocations could directly affect many of our students and would result in continued cuts in the university. And therefore, I hope that you will support this bill. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to touch back on your testimony regarding what's happened recently out at Eastern, and as I think the committee knows, and I think we'll hear maybe later at some point in time, about the retrenchment process, which was necessary. I think President Kenton would agree that it's necessary occasionally to be able to press the reset button and help the university engage in a process that enables a university to realign itself with the needs of its region and make sure that the programs and majors and degrees that it's offering are aligned with that demand and so forth. So I guess I take a little umbrage at your suggestion that that the rural students are going to be disenfranchised by that, because the programs or the majors that have been pared back or modified were those areas where there wasn't a great demand for that content anyway. And so my point would be, going forward, the university will be more efficient and they'll be more aligned with the economic and the needs of the region itself and provide the education that the area is looking for. So that's my understanding from talking to President Kenton.
Well, I understand that point, and I do agree, and I do think that we made major changes, and some of them were will be helpful. The point I would make is that an additional $2 million from our general fund would further degrade what we have. And it is an important, and we do serve a very specific role out in Eastern Oregon. And you know, we do take our role very seriously. And we do want to make things better for the students at Eastern Oregon University. And that's what I'm most concerned with. So.
Thanks. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Koreski, Mr. Bernard.
Hi, good morning. For the record, my name is Debbie Koreski from Portland State University, and I am here to kind of present the university administration's viewpoint. Mr. Bernard and I are appearing on behalf of all seven of the universities today and the President's Council that exists between us. We are from the first two universities that sought a governing board. Portland State University and University of Oregon were the first two to request a governing board from the legislature, so we kind of had a running head start. Oregon State University was the third, and then the two universities requested one not even quite a year later from that. So all seven boards, as you heard, are coming up online. Portland State and University of Oregon probably are a little bit farther ahead, along with Oregon State University, than the TRUES, just simply because our boards were appointed earlier. One of the things that I'd like to talk to you about is about the origin of the original bill. When Portland State University and University of Oregon requested a bill, it was a big uncertainty. And there were a lot of cost shifts that happened within the system. One in particular was PEB, is that if you're Portland State University, as soon as I say this, you'll nod your head and go, oh, of course, that makes sense. If you're Portland State University and you're in the metropolitan region, you have a lot of younger faculty. You have access to a lot of different options in the PEB system. A lot of your employees take the cheaper Kaiser option. You have a lot of part-time faculty that don't qualify for PEB. So our PEB costs were substantially lower than any other university in the system. If you are Southern or Eastern Oregon, you have a lot of older faculty who want the full meal deal from PEB. You don't have access to Kaiser. So you have more people opting for the expensive plan, right?
assessment. So it, while we were a system, one of the things that happened was the PEB rate was smoothed. So Portland State paid way more than what our expenses were to help lower the cost for Southern and Eastern. And that was a good thing, except that it was not really accounted for. It was just sort of, the pie was sort of split kind of willy-nilly. So if you were Portland State, you didn't really like that. You wanted to know, well, what are our true costs versus what is the extra that we're paying to help hold down the cost for the other universities? And so now we have a full accounting of that, and that's, we were happy about that. We're like, oh, good, this is our true cost, and this is the true cost for Southern, this is the true cost for Eastern. So
maybe we should say actual cost.
These are the actual costs.
Connotation here. Thank you.
And since that time, the President's Council, which meets once a month, and the Finance Council, the Finance VPs, have talked about how do you unwind this and still make it where Eastern, Southern, OIT, and Western can afford PEB. How does this happen without PSU kind of backdoor subsidizing that? And so one of the things that that we discovered was, well, you just take it off the top instead of taking it off the bottom and sort of taking a dollar from U of O or taking a $3 from PSU. Just say, this is what it costs at Southern Eastern and OIT and Western, and take that from the top. And those are, those types of agreements and those types of discussions are reflected in the letter from the seven presidents today, and then the letter from the HEC, which we're still waiting the decision from the HEC about, will they accept this type of agreement between the universities to, instead of doing it on the back end, to do it on the front end, to just say, here are the actual cost of risk management, here are the actual cost of PEB, and can we split that out? So those are the functions of the letters. And on behalf of the true universities, we have been asked to say, you know, the HEC has not agreed firmly to this type of approach. So, and we're still awaiting that decision. And one other thing that I'd just like to throw out there is that the boards are new, and they are coming up online. But one of the things that has happened at Portland State since 2007 is that every year we have spent more than we have taken in. Portland State has spent 8 years of living off of its reserves. We had reserves, and we've done that. And our board has said to our administration, no more. You're bleeding through your reserves. We're now going to start living within our means. So we are under a very, very tough conversation with our Finance and Administration Committee about what does that look like, what type of adjustments will we have to make, what does the state appropriation, this biennium, mean for that, what will our means be. And so those types of true accounting measures are particularly important for our university as we try to bring our cost in line with our actual revenues moving forward instead of relying on reserves, which we don't have anymore. I think the last thing that I'll leave you with, and I'll turn it over to Hans, who has a lot more knowledge of the ins and outs of how our shared services structure works because he attends all the finance meetings with the finance VPs, is that when this bill passed in 2013, a lot of people believed that each university would sort of strike out on its own. That was absolutely part of the narrative, that we wouldn't talk to one another anymore, that, and I would say as someone who came to the universities when we were a system versus how it is now, there is a significant more open and honest communication that exists among the seven institutions. We know that the truths have concerns about the cost and that they will need to see from the HEC that this approach of funding on the front end rather on the back end is so that they can be assured that they won't have significant deficits in their budget. So I will leave you with that and turn it over to Hans, and hopefully he can provide some more details.
Thank you. Mr. Bernard.
Good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hans Bernard with the University of Oregon. I'd like to pick up where Debbie left off and say that I think one of the great ironies of the restructuring has been that while there was fear that we would all go out and compete and not work together, I think I was not at the University of Oregon during the days of the university system, but the level of collaboration and communication amongst the seven presidents and their staff, I don't think has ever been higher. The two of us are here today to make very clear that we want all of our institutions to be successful and we want all of our institutions to be funded in a way that allows them to provide educational opportunities for Oregonians. I think it's safe to say that we agree with the intent of the bill in terms of an effort to control costs, ensure collaboration, and ensure that we can provide educational opportunities for students across Oregon. At this point, though, we don't believe that this bill is needed to accomplish those goals. When the boards came online, many of the services that were provided by the Chancellor's office went on to be provided by what's called the University Shared Services Enterprise, which is a collective of all of the institutions working together, managed by a board that consists of the finance vice president presidents for all seven universities. So the shared services that are optional, then the incentive is to keep those costs as low as possible so that the institutions want to stay in and continue to use those services. So at this point, you have the letter in front of you from the seven presidents. That came from the TRUES, and their vice presidents for finance sat down and did a very careful accounting of what were the costs of shared services, what were costs of some of the other services that used to be provided by the Chancellor's office that were no longer going to be provided, internal audit, legal services, some of those types of things, and what would be the cost to ensure that those campuses are met whole and kept whole. That dollar amount was then, and that spreadsheet was then carefully vetted by the seven vice presidents for finance from all the institutions to make sure that all the institutions had a good understanding of that document and felt comfortable with how those numbers had been identified. Once that conversation was completed and the seven vice presidents for finance were very comfortable with that spreadsheet, they recommended to the presidents that they request that the HEC include that dollar amount in the based funding for universities, the smaller technical and regional universities. That was done because we all, seven presidents and all seven campuses, want all of our institutions to be successful. We want that amount to be baked into the based funding right off the top to ensure that there's not an undue burden placed on these campuses. So we provided that letter to the HEC. They have given us a communication back. I think Debbie put an important caveat on this bill, and that is until we are certain that that is a direction that the HEC is ready to go in terms of putting that amount into a funding formula, we need to put an asterisk on this bill. I think we are here today on behalf of all of our colleagues. They would not feel comfortable if it does not get resolved in that way. So I think it's important to note that. But I also think it's it feels like a nice vote of confidence to the fact that they asked us to testify on behalf of this bill, encourage the committee to take a wait-and-see approach, and are comfortable allowing us to speak on their behalf. So thank you.
Thank you. I'm guessing that we may want to hear from the HEC, so I'm a little heads up. We might be asking Dana to come up in a minute. In the meantime, are there questions for either of these folks? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks to both of you for testifying. I do think that's a I think it's a good picture, a good gesture to have you up here pinch hitting for your colleagues, if you will. But I guess what I'd like to hear from you, or perhaps get you to just nod, if in fact this funding allocation could be, maybe just nod on the behalf of the TRUES, let's just say, if this could be baked into the formula as spelled out in the letter here. And then that alleviates some of the short-term, or at least the financial angst, I think, that perhaps the concerns that they might have about some of those missing gaps in shared services. But then in addition to that, enabling them to, or actually encouraging them to look for ways to operate as efficiently as they possibly can, and perhaps think outside, off the page, about some things that perhaps aren't even in view yet. But again, as individual universities recognizing they have a different mission, they have a different calling, they have a different set of circumstances and stuff. But my concern about extending this with these predetermined conditions here is that I think we're going to stifle creativity, and that would be my position. So any nods of yay or nay or indifference on that?
I think, thank you for the question, Chair Reed and Representative Johnson. I think one of the things that absolutely Hans and I have been on the front lines of is watching the universities come together and realizing that we have different expertise in different areas than the back of the house. And in fact, just last week, an issue happened at Portland State where we thought, we're going to have to go to outside counsel because we don't have an attorney on staff that can handle this. This is, you know, oh no. And the University of Oregon actually said, we have an attorney, we'll help you. And so that saved, that it's a perfect example of just how the collaboration and new ways of thinking about things. I'm not sure that we would have called University of Oregon previously, but because we all happened to be on a phone call together, the University of Oregon was like, we've done this, we know, we'll help you, and that's going to save us the cost of that outside counsel. And there's 100 other things to look at as we kind of move forward and forge ahead about, will some things maybe be more expensive? Sure. Will some things maybe be less expensive? Sure. And just that new dynamic and with the help of all these new board members who also, a lot of them bring significant financial expertise to the universities.
Let's go to Representative Wisnett, then Representative Gallegos, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Either one of you, is there a list of what shared services we've created and where they are located? And so was there competitive bidding between the universities to say, I can do this service for this? And did you look outside of government to provide those services?
So, Chair Reed, there is a list, and we can provide that to the committee. Similar to the conversation Debbie just mentioned about legal expertise, the conversation amongst the presidents was which institutions are best equipped to provide these services. Most of them are housed at the University Shared Services Enterprise, which is technically a function of Oregon State University, but a separate office and entity. They do most of them. The University of Oregon hosts and runs the retirement programs for all the seven campuses, and that was one that we took on because of some expertise that we had within our staff bandwidth. But it really was kind of a let's look across the institution, see where the strengths are, locate as many in one location as possible, but then if there were areas that other institutions had some depth in, let's go there.
And I would add to that the reason that Oregon State took on the vast majority of the back of the house enterprises was because the employees that did that in the chancellor's office were already located in Corvallis. So that prevented us from having to relocate, and it allowed us to retain the same staff that had done it before. They just do it now on behalf of the seven universities rather than the chancellor's office. So, and we kind of, everybody just sort of took what you were good at and where the employees were already. Like, we have all the bargaining because those employees were located in Portland, so they're housed at Portland State. So,
thank you. Representative Gallegos.
Yes, thank you very much for your testimony. Listening to you, it just seems to me that it really speaks to the need to continue giving us some more time, whether it's 6 years or whatever, to allow us to then, because you mentioned we've got 100 different things that we need to sort of think about in terms of pulling this stuff together. So it just seems to me that really argues to the fact that we do need more time, and also more time would allow the creative juices to flow and to really resolve these questions and issues. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yep.
Representative Hayden.
Chair Reed, thank you. It's been mentioned several times that the goal is to, or a reason for the goal is to meet the 40-40-20, and it, at the risk of questioning the status quo, with some of our universities, particularly with our push for technical side of training, that they may not necessarily be getting that four-year degree. Is there flexibility, or would there be flexibility in the future if one institution said, well, we like what you're trying to accomplish, but our goal may not best serve our population under the 40-40-20? Is there any conversation around the different makeup of the students of the university, what might best fit them in their geographical area?
So, Representative Reed, Representative Hayden, the way we are coordinated is and structured, we are responsive to the funding allocations and priorities of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, the HEC. So the funding formula that's developed by the HEC is done so with a strategic plan that they've adopted in the last year that really looks at where are the areas of growth in our demographics and where are the places where we're going to need to respond in order to meet 40-40-20. And I know Debbie can talk specifically about growth in minority populations in the Portland area and some of the efforts that Portland State has done in that regard. But I think it's safe to say that the HEC, when they put together that strategic plan, looked across the institutions and recognized that different institutions had a role in serving different populations around the state, and some had an additional role in providing educational opportunities for specific careers or industries that are important to the Oregon economy.
And I would add, Representative Hayden and Chair Reed, that I think it would be great for Oregon students if there was a College of Engineering at all seven of the universities. The truth is that we probably couldn't sustain that, especially nowhere close to the level of funding that we are. I mean, those high-cost, high-demand degrees, we know you guys have spent tons of time talking about that. We know we have an issue in filling that pipeline with students and pulling them through, whether it's they're not prepared coming out of high school to meet those demands, the cost of the programs are too high at Portland State. We are absolutely nearing capacity in our engineering school and in some of our high-demand business degrees like specialized accounting. Our faculty is retiring, and we're finding that we can't find faculty to replace them in our price range. Those faculty have become significantly more expensive, so we're having to juggle that and create wait lists for those. It's not that the students wouldn't get a job. We know that a lot of times they are placed before they ever graduate, but we know the universities are starting to struggle to meet those demands, and it's really directly attributable to at five of the universities, the undergraduate resignation rate is probably at the highest level that you can set it. At Portland State, that's certainly the truth. We need to keep our tuition pretty modest over the next 5 years so that we don't experience dropouts, and we need to see a state reinvestment so that we can start doing more of those things. So,
so I wanted to ask one question based on what I thought I heard from you, which is essentially an argument that the financial elements of shared services can be covered through, and I realize I'm overgeneralizing here, through agreement on, I think you said, the top end rather than the bottom end. If that's true, it seems that there are at least a couple of other elements that remain around collective bargaining, around participation in out of PERS and PEB. How do you react to that if the financial elements are taken care of in the way you describe? It seems like there are those remaining issues.
So, Chair Reed, thank you for the question. I would one day like to become a collective bargaining expert, but I am not today and probably will not be over the next 2 years. It is our understanding, the universities have one contract that they bargain collectively. That's the SEIU contract. All other contracts, like the Portland State AAUP bargaining unit, is separate than the bargaining unit for faculty at U of O. So that's the one collective contract. It is our understanding that bargaining unit would have to say that they wanted to either bargain individually with the units, that we don't have that ability to say we want. I mean, we do have some additional options because we are seven separate legal entities, but that they would have to choose that as the bargaining unit. They would have to decertify their collective bargaining unit and then recertify. And my apologies if that's not 100% accurate, but with the caveat of I am not an expert in collective bargaining at all. So. And then I think your other questions was about PEB or PERS. There have been significant conversations, particularly about PEB. There's a report from the Chancellor's Office that does show the impact of opting out of PEB for Oregon's universities, and frankly, it's a cost savings. But there, just like Senator Denbrough mentioned, there are other factors in that conversation. It's not for lack of the universities raising the question about, hey, what if we could look outside, maybe go into the private marketplace? And I think we've had a pretty clear answer from the legislature and the governor's office that is not something that is going to be feasible for the universities over any time in the near future.
So I just want to make sure I understand that. In the scenario that everyone came to agreement that the financial elements were handled through an arrangement, something like what you described, you would still be opposed to a bill that said that dealt with the PEB and PERS participation and bargaining, or did I misunderstand that?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, so we're up here now. I feel like I need to state that this would be the opinion of my institution, sure. And sure. I have not had a chance to have this conversation with my colleagues. I think it's safe to say that the answer would be yes, and I think that is reflective of the conversation that has been had in the legislature and with the governor in the last several years about wanting to provide institutional governing boards the maximum level of autonomy possible to manage and govern their institutions and reserve the coordinating for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to look across the continuum and look at how our community colleges, universities, and financial aid systems work together to serve students, but really leave the management of the institutions to the boards of trustees that this legislature approved.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, and on behalf of Portland State University, especially on behalf of our board and our administration, if you've not tracked the PEP conversation with the universities very closely, it is complex, and there are significant concerns, understandably, from employees who would say, what would this mean to me? What would this mean to my health benefits? And there are potential impacts to the overall PEP pool, which may drive up cost to the overall PEP pool. Those should be paid attention. But, you know, my board's responsibility and my administration's responsibility is to keep costs down for Portland State University students, and I think it's fair to say that there would be some savings there. So I think for that reason, because it would not allow us to continue to really raise that issue and advocate on behalf of that agreeably narrow viewpoint, that we would probably have some significant concerns about that.
Got it. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay. I think that's it for today.
Thank you.
Do you want to hear from the HEC their description on? Okay. Dana, would you mind coming up and giving us an update, please? Always nice when someone else refers to you, right? And you were, I'm sure, prepared to have this conversation this morning. I appreciate
your
flexibility.
Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dana Richardson, Deputy Director for Policy and Legislative Affairs at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, I'll start with the question. I think we would like to hear your assessment or sort of update when Portland State and U of O referred to their interest in the HEC's decision around accounting for shared services on the top line versus the bottom line. They talked about awaiting a HEC decision, so perhaps you could give us an update on that process.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There has been submitted, it's on OLIS, available for this committee and affiliated with this bill, an indication that their recommendation, and it's $12 million plus, is that was pretty much what we were planning to do, is use that, I guess, off the top $12 million plus figure within our outcomes-based funding formula.
Okay. So is there a point at which that becomes an official action? It sounds like they're waiting for the HEC to make that official.
So, Mr. Chair, we're in rulemaking right now regarding the outcomes-based funding. So as part of that process, it would be finalized through our rulemaking, which is it's in a public comment period right now.
Okay. And when do you expect that to happen?
That will wrap up, I believe, in this month or early next month.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, could you explain off the top versus the bottom for us? I'm not getting the whole concept.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Wisnett, I think the idea is that you just agree to set it aside as opposed to running it through the formula, if that makes sense. So that the institutions would be assured of receiving that amount.
So essentially you're agreeing to an amount at the beginning instead of saying here's the formula that's distributed to various institutions based on their expected or actual costs. Is that a fair?
Or completions or whatever the rubric is for determining the distribution.
Follow up.
Please.
So you're saying one of the things being considered is performance.
In the proposed model, yes.
So have you seen that model? Do you know what it's called?
I have not seen that model elsewhere, no. I'm trying to pick it up as fast as you are. Representative Hayden.
Chair Reed.
Has there been a cost comparison to staying with the PEB program versus interacting with the private market for the health insurance for the universities as a whole? Has that been looked at?
So, Chair Reed and Representative Hayden, with my understanding is within the shared services work group that was referenced earlier that the institutions have been participating in, that they have been developing that sort of information.
And I think one comment to add to that question, it would be an interesting question to ask individual institutions versus the system as a whole versus the university system as a whole versus the PEB system as a whole. The answers might be different
Sure. Depending
on those
Agreed.
Scenarios. Obviously, you were thinking that too. Other questions?
Not today, but coming.
Not today, but more to come. I'm
Thank
sure
you.
That's true for all of us.
Complicated.
Thank you very much. So obviously some more substantive things today and more to think about. We appreciate the testimony. That's the list on House Bill 2611. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on that bill? Don't see any. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2611. That also completes our agenda for today. Is there anything else to come before the committee? We have that. Ready to go? Okay. So we are adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.